This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, has the Green Party's Jill Stein become a collaborator with the Democrats? Bruce Dixon says nothing could be further from the truth. Why are the Democrats blaming the Russians for their loss at the polls? We'll ask anti-war activist David Swanson. And the Black is Back Coalition gets ready to rally for Black self-determination next month in the nation's capital. But first, Ajamu Baraka, who ran for vice president on the Green Party ticket, was a featured speaker at a conference of Southern human rights organizers in Jackson, Mississippi. Baraka was a co-founder of the U.S. Human Rights Network. He believes that progressive voters were too scared of Donald Trump to give the Greens a try.
I had a chance to be a part of a very historic run here in 2016 on the Green Party ticket, getting a chance to move across this country and to interact with people across the country who were, in very many ways, looking for a change. But we know that that change wasn't always clearly expressed, because at the same time the people were looking for change, there was great concern about the challenge coming from the far right in the form of the Trump campaign. I say far right because we know that the political trajectory of the Democratic Party has also been moving consistently to the right. So we had a framing of the choices between the far right, the more crude and aggressive, almost neo-fascist right, and the neoliberal capitalist right represented by Hillary Clinton, and the new political realignment that was taking place among even the ruling class that were lining up in support of Hillary Clinton because of their concerns about the inability to control Donald Trump. And they were lining up behind Hillary Clinton, not because they were concerned about Donald Trump being a racist or xenophobic, any of that kind of stuff. They don't care about that. That's been the centerpiece of U.S. politics from the very beginning and the centerpiece of the Republican strategy for the last few decades. What they were concerned about was the new constellation of class forces lining up behind Trump, situated around and in the national bourgeoisie, if you will. That is that element of the ruling class that's primarily concerned with the economic situation in the U.S., as opposed to the hegemony over the last few decades of the transnational bourgeoisie centered in the U.S., but with an agenda that is geared toward expanding and developing what we call neoliberal globalization. And they were concerned about Trump undermining that agenda. That's why they were lining up behind the neoliberal politics of Hillary Clinton, okay? Saying all that though, people were still understanding that they needed a change and wanted a change, but because, you know, of this Trump challenge, you know, they were concerned that drawing a land in the sand, drawing a line in the sand and building a real alternative political opposition within this electoral process, they were concerned that if they did that, if they stood with the Green Party challenge, that in fact that would be a vote for Donald Trump. And we know that the propaganda was very effective in fact advancing that notion, even in a state like Mississippi, in which there was no way that Hillary Clinton was going to win. So basically, all of you all who voted for Hillary Clinton, you basically voted, you know, wasted your vote. The Green Party could use that vote because this is a red state. It was going to remain a red state. So even if you wanted to vote Democrat all the way down the line, you could have voted for the Green Party at the top of the ticket, and the party could have used that vote in terms of trying to get that 5% in order to be prepared and in a better position to challenge in 2020. But we couldn't penetrate the bourgeois propaganda to get that message out to the people. But it just shows the limitation of this democratic, so-called democratic process here in this country. What was affirmed to me moving around this country was the fact that people were in fact ready for change, but they were afraid. Yeah. And they were ready for change because, you know, in many of these major cities that I went through, you know, Baltimore, Atlanta, D.C., Philly, Chicago, where the working class in general and African people and Latino people specifically were catching hell, all of these cities were controlled by Democrats. So this issue the target of the Democratic Party is not just the National Democrats, but the whole Democratic Party apparatus. And the fact that the Democratic Party apparatus is firmly grounded and committed to advancing a neoliberal agenda, they are committed to advancing white power, and that we see the consequence of those policies being played out at the city level across this country. School cutbacks, the concentration of repression in our communities, the elimination of government services, the collusion between the government and the local ruling class, the encouragement of what you all call gentrification, I call urban colonization across this country. It is a pattern of repression, a pattern of oppression all across this country, all being administered and managed by the Democrats. So people are becoming more and more clear that, you know, we have enemies. And enemies cannot just be associated with the so-called Republicans. That's right. That in my estimation, the enemy also has to be identified as the Democratic Party that is in collusion with and supported by this national and international bourgeoisie. Right. So, and I'm going to end here in terms of my very short comments. That basically, we've got to begin, and I think we started this conversation these last couple of days, we've got to identify the enemies. We've got to take our political discourse and give it some more concreteness. Because oftentimes, you know, we're a little bit too abstract. We talk about things, we want to be liberated. Liberated from what? We've got to become more clear. We've got to begin to not only become more clear, but begin to offer a clearer vision. You know, in our campaign, at least the way I framed it, I said that, you know, there'll be no lies, no compromise, and no fear. We offered a transitional program, and we said transitional, meaning that basically the things that we had in that platform, the struggle for a universal health care, the struggle for a guaranteed minimum wage income, the struggle for a living wage, the two things now. We're talking about guaranteed minimum wage, but we also say that we want a living wage, okay? And that's $15 and above. You know, we say that we have to not only break up the banks, but I go further and say we've got to break up those banks and take control of those banks. It makes no sense that we have a Federal Reserve that has control over U.S. monetary policy, and that's in the hands of private bankers. That's absurd. We have to take that back control for the people. You know, we say that we're not going to continue to allow for polluters to destroy our communities by polluting the land, by polluting the air. We say we have to be committed to a program of transforming the economy into a green economy, 100% clean, renewable energy, and that we can do that and also create jobs. Jobs that we would create and concentrate in urban areas, for example, retrain people. But all of that we say that we have to struggle for. And in the process of struggling for, we also have to recognize that, and this is where the issue of no lies comes in, that things are going to get worse before they get better. They're going to get worse, my friends, because as many people have said a few times this week, This neoliberal capitalist economy is at its historical end. It is, in fact, coming apart. It's still strong, but in the process of it continuing its normal operating functions, it's generating contradictions that you just can't wish away. And one of the contradictions that we have to deal with as African people in this country, or Black people, however you all want to define yourself, is that for the first time in this country's history, Black folks, Black workers, are no longer needed. We are now a superfluous population, a redundant population. We are what the board used to talk about, but in a very real way, we are the social problem. Okay. And how do you deal with a social problem? A group of people who you no longer need. You police them. You incarcerate them. You repress them. So basically, we have to understand what we're up against today. And so we understand what we're up against today, then we understand the terms of the war being waged against us. And we have an urgency now to get absolutely clear about the terms of that war and what we have to do in terms of developing institutions and structures to be able to not only resist, but to advance a notion, a vision that goes beyond this society.
Ajamu Baraka is also an editor and columnist for Black Agenda Report. Bruce Dixon, the managing editor of Black Agenda Report, is also a co-chair of the Georgia chapter of the Green Party. Dixon was recently interviewed by Ann Garrison on Pacifica radio station KPFA in Berkeley, California. He was asked, why is Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein forcing a recount of the vote in three Midwestern states?
There are some of our friends who believe that Stein and the Greens are jumping into bed with the Democrats by doing this, and I want to assure them that this is not the case, that the Stein campaign is not filing this recount to put Hillary in the White House or to restore the fortunes of Democrats. The reason that we're doing this is that the Green Party has hundreds of candidates for local office who are going to be running all across the country in the year 2017. We're talking mayors, school board, tax commissioners, county commissioners, and the like. And how are we going to ignore persuasive evidence of widespread multi-state vote tampering this year in 2016 and then turn around in 2017 and tell people that they should campaign for office? We need to protect our candidates who are running for office in 2017 and 2018 by pursuing these allegations of widespread vote tampering and letting the chips fall where they may, investigating this stuff. If we don't do this, then we're going to be awful hypocrites asking people to run for office on a local basis. So we're doing this for our own reasons, not for reasons that the Democrats have. What is a salient characteristic of all three states that many of our friends on the left have pointed out to us is that all three of these are states where Hillary was predicted to win, but Trump narrowly won instead. And some of our friends have come to us and said, why didn't the Stein campaign file do this in a more even-handed way? If you're not in the Democrats' pocket, how come you only filed in states where Trump won? How come you didn't file in some of the states where Hillary won? And the answer to that is that Democrats and Republicans steal votes in different ways. Republican vote tampering via machines on Election Day is a tactic that is just at one end of a continuum that includes voter caging, voter ID laws, residency laws, and laws that disenfranchise people with felony convictions. Republicans you see across the country are at a demographic disadvantage. The Republican-leaning constituencies are getting smaller, and the constituencies that lean away from the Republican Party are getting larger. So the Republican tactic in general elections is to try to make thousands and even hundreds of thousands of Democratic voters, millions of Democratic voters, disappear with voter ID laws, with exclusions from the ballot for spurious reasons, with this cross-check system that Greg Palast wrote so eloquently about, and other kinds of legislative and administrative means. You don't see Democrats doing that to Republicans. Nobody's passing laws that disenfranchise whole groups of Republican voters. Nobody's executing things on Election Day that make thousands of Republican voters get provisional ballots, which are then not counted. That doesn't happen. That's not the way Democrats play it. What Democrats do in general elections against Republicans is they just try to raise their voter registration and raise their turnout. They don't have to steal against Republicans. All they got to do is try to make sure their voters register and come out. Hillary failed to do that this time, and Hillary lost. Where Democrats steal elections is, as you will know, being a California audience, is in the primaries. In Massachusetts, I understand that Bernie Sanders lost all the precincts that had voting machines. Hillary won in all of those, and Bernie won in all the ones that had paper ballots. How did that happen, and why didn't Bernie's people challenge that? If Hillary is supposed to be on board now, Hillary's campaign has said that they are cooperating with our recount effort. Yeah, right. How could they not cooperate with it? They haven't endorsed it, but they're not going to refuse cooperation. But really, if Hillary was about accountable elections and making sure that every vote counted and every vote was counted, Hillary should have been asked to explain what happened there in Massachusetts. And Bernie should be asked why he didn't file a complaint for a recount then. We think it was because he just wanted to stay in the club. In California, the way I understand it from every California Democratic activist and Green activist that I know, the election was stolen from Bernie by the Hillary people. And we couldn't file a recount thing about that. That was the job of Bernie and his campaign to do it. People should be asking why Bernie's people didn't file for a recount in California, why they didn't take measures to denounce the blatant vote theft that happened there. And they should be asking Hillary to explain those results, too. And that's why the Green Party didn't file for recounts in states where Hillary won, because Democrats don't steal from Republicans. Democrats only steal from their left opposition in their own primaries, or if they can, from Greens.
I think the argument in California is that there are a great many independent voters here, and they asked for Democratic ballots at the polls and weren't able to get them.
In any case, from what I understand, talking to lots of California folks, including lots of real registered, functional, mid-level Democrats in Democratic parties in Long Beach and other places like that, is that it was stolen. It was stolen. And the fact is that Bernie's people did not file for a recount. Greg Palast claims that the election results were announced the same night when more than a million votes in L.A. County had not even been counted. So, you know, the question there is, you know, the question to Hillary's people is what happened, and the question to Bernie's people is why didn't they file for recounts, and why didn't they vigorously denounce the theft of that election? It seems that Bernie and his people were too intent on staying in the club. And that's the difference between the Green Party and Democrats and Republicans. When Donald Trump visited the White House and met Barack Obama for the first time, what did Barack say? He said, oh, we're on the same team. It's a relay team, and I'm passing the baton to him. Well, in the Green Party, we think that Barack is half right. They are on the same team, but it's not a relay team. It's a sleazy wrestling tag team. And Barack is tagging out, and now Trump is tagging in. And you know, Trump, Hillary, and Barack are all on the same side, and it's not our side. It's not the side that the Green Party is on. The Green Party is the only party that stands for counting every vote and making sure every vote counts. And that's why we filed this petition for recounts in those three states.
Okay. Jill Stein's campaign was able to raise more money in a matter of days than they were able to raise all year. How do you think that happened?
Twice as much, actually. The campaign raised and spent about $3.5 million. And the goal, which they seem to be on track to achieve by early this week for recounts in three states, is $7 million. That's just how much it costs. That's not how much the Stein campaign decided to spend. That's how much it actually costs. The deal there is that during the campaign, our message was kept a secret from a lot of the people who went to the polls. There were plenty of people who didn't even know there was such a thing as a Green Party or a Green Party candidate. Millions of voters didn't know that. What happened with Bernie, not that he was just such a great genius or anything, but the fact that he had a compelling message that people wanted to see, and unlike what was done with the Green Party, where corporate media and the private corporation that is staffed only by Republicans and Democrats that manages the debates, they managed to keep us away from the eyeballs and the ears of voters, They couldn't do this with Bernie because he was in the Democratic primary, and he got to stand toe-to-toe with Hillary on TV, and they could not conceal what his message was. They could lie about him, but they had to let him speak unfiltered in front of audiences on national TV and radio for hours. And that's what got Bernie's message across. That's what got millions of voters for Bernie, and that's what got thousands of activists pushing the Bernie Sanders campaign. If we had had that kind of access, we'd be way in double digits, too. So the deal here is that the fact is that for many of these people, this is the first time they've heard of the Green Party and Jill Stein. And if they had been aware of Jill Stein and the Green Party during the elections, many of these people would have participated in our campaign, would have donated to our campaign, but they were not aware of us until the news became public that we were challenging for a recount in these three states. It's just a function of people knowing we exist and knowing what our message is. Now, it is true that MoveOn.org and some other Democratic allied outfits have actually told their people to consider contributing to Jill Stein. Daily Kos, which is a Democratic Party website, earlier in the year, really since the beginning of the year, has threatened to ban from their website anybody who mentioned Jill Stein or who mentioned Green Party.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, and now all of a sudden, they're covering us, you know, like mad, allowing people to find out who we are and sending them to our website where they do get a load of our actual message. And it has a lot in common with what Bernie's message is, only we think it goes a lot further in many respects. And so we're getting donations and offers of help and collaboration from some of these people. The $7 million, I think we're now at, since yesterday, I think yesterday there were over $5 million. But the average donation is less than $45. So we're talking about tens of thousands of small contributors. Now, these are people who may have contributed, many of them, to Democrats in the past. So who call this Democratic money are obscuring the difference. There's Democratic money and there's Democratic money. There's the money that one percenters give to the Democratic Party in big checks. Bill Maher gave $1 million to the Democratic Party. There's sit-downs in Hollywood, you know, that cost $20,000 apiece. There's money from military contractors and bundlers who hand over hundreds of thousands of dollars to Hillary Clinton at a time. That's money from one percenters. The money that we're getting from nominal Democrats or people who used to be Democrats or people who are on the fence about that is small donations. Like I said, the average one is $45.
Bruce Dixon, managing editor of Black Agenda Report. The Democratic Party seems to have gone Russia crazy, blaming the Kremlin for Hillary Clinton's loss to Donald Trump and smearing websites that don't toe the U.S. line on foreign policy as dupes of the Russians, including Black Agenda Report. We spoke with veteran anti-war activist David Swanson, publisher of the influential website War is a Crime.
As you know, the powers in the Democratic Party and in the DNC preferred Trump to Bernie Sanders. That choice was very clear. They wanted Hillary Clinton first choice, the Republican second choice, Bernie Sanders distant third. He was clearly the more powerful, politically superior as well as morally superior, although deeply flawed, candidate, and they didn't want that. You know, they wanted Hillary or nothing, and that's what they got. And many of those people still feel the same way. Think they're doing fine. They just need more of it. They want to put in power walking disasters like Schumer and Pelosi and carry on. The move to give more power to people like Bernie Sanders or to make Keith Ellison the chair of the Democratic Committee, that's the extent of sort of the fringe radicalism within the Democratic Party. And it doesn't go very far. And it is challenged heatedly by many of those in power in that party. The smears of Keith Ellison as anti-Semitic and other attacks on him are motivated by a desire to make the Democrats more Republican, not turn the Democrats into some sort of alternative to the Republicans. I'm not a big fan of Keith Ellison. He pushed hard and early and vigorously for the illegal and murderous overthrow of the government of Libya and claimed it was a wonderful, glowing success and a model for Syria, and has been pushing for a illegal and murderous no-fly zone in Syria ever since. I don't think that's progressive or radical or leftist or an alternative to a Republican Party. But of course, he soars over that low hurdle of above average Democrats, as does Bernie Sanders. And I think when the Democrats tell each other that the demographics are on their side, that's very much true. When they tell each other that they had a winning candidate in Bernie Sanders and cheated him out of the nomination, that's very likely true. But that they have people like Bernie Sanders who won't stand up and fight for themselves, and their whole party won't stand up and fight for itself, and the idea of actually counting the votes in states that look questionable is considered deeply unacceptable and inappropriate. You know, and Hillary Clinton's being dragged into giving a damn about her own election by Jill Stein and attorney friends of mine who pushed Jill Stein into it. So, you know, the Democratic Party, in my mind, needs to be abandoned. And the idea of taking it over and reforming it and fixing it at least needs to be recognized as old. The idea that that's a new proposal every year for my whole lifetime is just getting a little tiresome.
Yes, certainly the bar for being described as a progressive within the Democratic Party is very low. As you said, Keith Ellison was in favor of the Libyan war and continues to be in favor of the Syrian war. How do we arrive at a state where people are called progressive who are in fact pro-war?
Well, because it's sort of graded on a curve, and you take whoever's the least horrible members of Congress and say they're the lesser evil, just as people do with electoral candidates for president or anything else, and then you start filtering news so that you only hear good things about your lesser evil hero until you've deluded yourself that they're a glorious messiah. You know, I mean, this is what someone like Michael Moore did as a prominent public example, who was, you know, go back and read his tweet, honestly, accurately denouncing Hillary Clinton as a Wall Street warmonger and so forth during the primary, and then watch his film glorifying her as almost a saint during the general election. This is what people do in looking at Washington, D.C. And so if Keith Ellison is better than Schumer or Pelosi or McCain or somebody else in Washington, well, then he's not just better, he's great. And anything negative about him, we must avoid knowing. There's also, along with that, the draining away of the whole idea of holding people accountable. So that, you know, the Congressional Progressive Caucus, back before Keith Ellison showed up and became a co-chair, used to make commitments to things. You know, there was a time early on in the war on Iraq, I think 90 of them committed to voting no on any more war money. And then almost all of them went back on that. And many of them committed to voting no on Obamacare unless it had some sort of token pretense of a public option nonsense in there. And then they all went back on that. And so they stopped making commitments to anything because nobody took them seriously anymore. And now they just make statements about stuff that nobody reads. And so I think, you know, we, the public, have to demand that people who are going to call themselves a progressive caucus, this totally optional thing, they don't have to do it. They have to actually take a stand for progressive things or get the heck out and form a weak-kneed hypocrite caucus or something.
And as you said, it infects the whole of the body politic in the United States, even outside the Democratic Party. As you mentioned, the Green Party's Jill Stein had an anti-war platform, but after the election, she joins in the call for a recount on the basis of the Russians did it.
Did Jill Stein say that?
That is what is at the top of her complaint. The complaint is for an investigation into the tabulating of the election results in those three states to explore whether there was outside foreign influence. That's the top item.
Yeah, it's very, very dangerous and disappointing. I heard my friend John Boniface, one of the lawyers who urged Jill Stein to do this on Democracy Now! This morning, make a similar comment that leading up to the election, there was corporate media consensus that there was foreign interference likely in the U.S. election. And then after the election, there was opposition to investigating whether there had been any interference. And I think his trying to point out that hypocrisy is perhaps has some merit, but to bring up that topic and not denounce the whole Red Scare, Cold War, liberal McCarthyist danger that is upon us, I think is a little reckless. The Congress is trying to commit to create in this Intelligence Authorization Act and just did something similar in the Defense Act, so-called, a committee, a McCarthyite committee with members appointed by cabinet secretaries, a director of the FBI among them, to do anything the president wants with no public accountability to counter all sorts of Russian activities, real or fantasized. It's going to give free rein to cracking down on political opponents and journalists and whistleblowers and activists, and who knows what it's going to do to the Cold War with Russia. That, you know, a silver lining of Trump's disastrous victory was that he was actually talking in more friendly terms with Russia. You know, that was a backing away from a potential nuclear World War III. That was a nice silver lining. And here Congress is insisting on heightened tensions with Russia. The very next section of the same bill bans Russian diplomats and only Russian diplomats in the United States from traveling more than 25 miles from their offices. This is incredible to me that McCarthyism is now bipartisan establishment pushed by liberals, and liberal and progressive members, including John Conyers, you know, are demanding that the White House show them the evidence of what they assert without any evidence exists, and that is Russian interference in the election. This is a danger that has to be brought up whenever the foreign interference in the election gets mentioned.
And as you said, it's bipartisan. The Republicans used to be the big McCarthyites. Now it's the Democrats, but that bill wouldn't be getting through the Congress without lots of Republican support. And supposedly their standard bearer, the president-elect, wants to lessen tensions with Russians.
Supposedly, yeah. And, you know, we saw President Obama sell billions of dollars of weapons to Taiwan, and then President-elect Trump, or President-Select Trump, whatever you want to call him, popular vote loser Trump, take a phone call from Taiwan and catch flack for it. Why is it okay to sell billions of dollars of weapons to someone but not to talk to them on the phone? This is the standard. And when it comes to positions on policies, on factual claims, on what's an acceptable news source in Washington, D.C., you know, it comes down to what is the party line of the Republicans or the Democrats. And the line of the Democrats is that being friendly with Russia is evil. And so you now have in the minds of liberals in the United States this association of racism and sexism and cruelty to the disabled and anti-Muslim, anti-Mexican bigotry, and everything negative about Trump goes hand in hand with backing away from World War III with Russia. That stuff is just all grouped together. And so the good liberal position, the correct politics, is to be anti-racist, anti-sexist, et cetera, and pro-hostility toward Russia. And crazier still is that it's all being done without a shred of public evidence. There is no evidence of Russia manipulating the U.S. media, manipulating the U.S. elections, committing terrorism and assassinations in the United States or elsewhere. And yet you have this committee set up to go after these covert and, depending on how you read it, also overt actions. So there, this may be a crackdown on openly Russian broadcast outlets like RT and Sputnik in a way that we've seen in the U.K. already.
And the threat to supposedly pro-Russian outlets, like those of us who were named by the Washington Post via this anonymous source at Propaganda or Not, as being dupes of Russia.
Yes, indeed. 3 or 4 years ago, a Russian Air Force officer actually approached me and asked me if I would publish stuff he gave me under my own name. And I told him to go to hell and blogged publicly about the incident. But apart from that failed small propaganda effort, I'm not aware of Russian propaganda efforts in the United States, and the people making noise about it haven't shown us, pointed us to a shred of actual evidence, other than publishing this list of 200 media outlets, some of them, you know, UFO sites and so forth, but many of them the top sources of accurate, reliable news information for many of us in the United States. And I've actually started telling people who ask, where should we look for real news? I say, go to the places that the Washington Post tells you not to go. Those are the places to go. And I'm proud to say I've published in at least 18 of those supposedly Russian fake news outlets that, of course, have no connection, you know, other than RT and those openly Russian outlets on that list, have no connection to Russia. And I've had no connection to Russia, and I've not got a dime from Russia or from any of those outlets for that matter. It's absolutely outrageous that people have no principles. And once you attach the word Trump to something, you can denounce it. Trump is against protecting the natural environment, so I'm against Trump, great. But Trump is also against a nuclear war, or Trump is against greater war in the Middle East, or hostility toward Russia, well, then I'm for it. It's absolute lack of principle, giving way to total partisanship, is, you know, extremely dangerous.
Yes, it seems like a bizarre kind of game of musical chairs, where the Democrats sit down in the old Republican chair, and the Republicans then sit down on the old Democratic chairs, and all of the ills of both sets of chairs remain.
Yeah, and then they're all ugly chairs. There's no good players here, you know, and Trump wants hostility with China instead of Russia, and so, you know, that may become the position of his followers. You know, the big question I have is, of all the people who followed the Democratic line during the past 8 years and watched Bush's powers be expanded and exacerbated and seen the announcement that the president goes through a list of men, women, and children on Tuesdays and picks whom to murder with drones and so forth, and just accepted or avoided knowing that and kept it in the back of their heads. Now that those powers become Republican, now that it's Trump waging all the ongoing wars, failing to end them, maybe creating new ones, maybe murdering more people with drones, now will people get outraged, as I think they would have 5 years ago if they had heard that, you know, it was a Republican doing some of these things? Or is it too late for that? You know, have people accepted wars without Congress, wars without legal fig leaf, murder of anybody anywhere at presidential discretion, crackdowns on whistleblowers, absolute surveillance, that, you know, have people accepted all of that so deeply because it was Obama doing it that now they can't oppose it? And now Trump will do these things and people won't turn out in the streets and resist the way that I think they would have several years ago. This is the big question in my mind.
If that is true, what you are describing is a people, not just a government, that is a danger to the rest of humanity.
No question whatsoever. You know, you can't generalize about every person in the United States, but you survey people in the United States and they are far more accepting of war than people in most countries, and accepting of their government's investment in war, which about equals every other country put together. They are far more accepting of discrimination against the rest of the world, of exceptionalism for their country alone. And these sorts of public attitudes are indeed a threat to the globe. And if putting Donald Trump's face on that is helpful in some ways, I'm glad for it. You know, we had people and governmental leaders around the globe accepting crimes and abuses from Washington because it was Obama, the peace laureate, in charge. If your local U.S. military base in your country is now seen as the sign of your subservience to the odious Donald Trump, and that leads to some resistance to U.S. domination of the world, some effective nonviolent resistance, so much the better. But whether that's actually going to happen remains to be seen. And which of Trump's better promises he follows through on, and which of his worse threats he follows through on remains to be seen, although his nominees for top posts thus far suggest the worst of those possibilities.
Yes, it appears that Donald Trump, at least in terms of lessening tensions and in terms of delivering American workers from neoliberalism, is a party of one.
Because his nominees don't share those views?
It appears that way.
Yeah, I never thought he would do a bit of good for any American workers. I had some hopes that he would resist the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which I think he will, and possibly NAFTA, which I think he won't. But what he would put in their place and whether it would be better or worse remains to be seen. But I did have some hopes that he would scale back the Cold War with Russia, that he would possibly scale back NATO's aggressive expansion, that he would possibly halt the wars of regime change. But the people he's picking for high office, his plans to escalate military spending, which always leads to more wars, despite the counterfactual myth in U.S. society that more military spending somehow creates fewer wars. These are all dangerous signs, and he is putting in place some people who have a reckless tendency to blurt out the truth once in a while about drones or about Israel and so forth. But he's also putting in place people who are reckless and enthusiastic warmongers who get their enjoyment out of life from killing people and who want war on Iran and who are not legally available to nominate because they haven't been out of the military enough years. This suggests that he is going to be moved by those around him in a very dangerous direction, which is going to be good for the growth of the peace movement, but it's not a price worth paying for that.
Yes, this General Flynn, National Security Advisor, tried to link Iran to the jihadist actions in Benghazi. And Iran is a Shiite nation, which is the target of the Takfiri jihadist Sunnis.
Yeah, this is a problem with Trump and those around him and with fake news as an actual problem, not a McCarthyite scare from the Washington Post. People accept baseless claims as if they're legitimate because they want to and push them forward. And baseless, bigoted, and racist warmongering claims. And Flynn and his son are among those who do this, as is, of course, Donald Trump. On the other hand, you have someone like Flynn pointing out that killing people with drones is counterproductive on its own terms, and that these wars are in many ways counterproductive on their own terms. Now, in part, that's because he wants to torture people instead of killing them. And then you have Mattis, who gets his thrills out of murdering civilians in Fallujah and brags about how fun it is, but who says he's against torture because he admits it doesn't work, and he sees Israel as creating an apartheid state. So these are people who are reckless enough to sometimes blurt out the truth, but also reckless enough to pull nonsense justifications for dangerous behavior out of the internet. And who's going to be the adult who's going to push them in their good directions and away from their bad ones? Donald Trump. So there's a disaster waiting to happen. There's no responsible person among the crowd there.
That was anti-war activist David Swanson speaking from Washington. The Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations is mobilizing for a rally in the nation's capital next month. While other groups will be expressing their anger at or support for Donald Trump, Black is Back Chairman Omali Yeshitela says the coalition will gather to demand Black self-determination on January 14th.
This is 6 days before the inauguration of Donald Trump. And I think it's going to be an important mobilization. And a lot of people are going to be in Washington, D.C. for the inauguration. And I'm talking about people who are opposed to the Trump election, then some perhaps will even oppose to the system itself. And then I've seen that Al Sharpton has also decided to be in Washington, D.C. on January 14th, also under the slogan, "We shall not be moved," or something to that effect. But the Black is Black Coalition has, I believe, made an important opening in the struggle of our people in this country. And I think that began with the inception of the coalition itself nearly 8 years ago. But I think right now, what the Black is Back Coalition is doing is extremely important because we offered the only meaningful, organized, broad-based response to the entire electoral process, to the Hillary Clinton, Democrat, Donald Trump, Republican play that was happening throughout this country, and offered ordinary African people, Black people, an opportunity to have a voice and to be able to express their disagreements, not only with Trump, be able to come out not only because of fear of the Trump regime, but also in opposition to the Democratic Party and Hillary Clinton as well. And I think that the Black is Back Coalition served that incredible purpose. And I think going to Washington, D.C. on January 4th is also a part of this process. And it is a part of the process of replacing, moving out of the way those sellout opportunist leaders who have pretended to represent the interests of our people for a long time now, and without any kind of organized and coherent response to it. So now we have honest activists who have good reputations for trying to serve the people, but who have been without the kind of united effort that the coalition provides for us. And so that's why we're going into Washington, D.C. We're going to Washington, D.C. on January 14th, which, as you know, is the day before the anniversary of the birth of Dr. Martin Luther King. And we're going to be calling to rally for self-determination. And this is a part of our process of the coalition that put forth our own 19-point platform, our own set of demands for self-determination. And I think that's going to be just part of a whole critical development in this country as far as the struggle of our people is concerned.
In the hysteria that followed Donald Trump's election, some folks seem to blame the election results on identity politics, which appears to be folks who raised issues dealing with Black folks or brown folks or someone whose identity is other than white.
I think identity politics is at play, but clearly what we just saw was a white people's election. You know, 100 million people or so didn't even vote at all. And a lot of people said a pox on both your houses, and Trump was elected with 25% of the vote. And, yeah, people are talking about identity politics, and I think it's really interesting to watch this because it's coming from various sectors of the liberal Democratic establishment who now discovered that Trump is right about one thing, and that is that the Democratic Party and the political establishment have neglected or overlooked the interests of white workers. And so it's interesting to listen to how most of all of the analysis that I hear coming from the Democratic Party establishment and even its left wing is talking about recovering its place by now going after white workers. So this attack on the so-called identity politic is, as you suggested, an attack on politic that would dare to suggest that the interests of African people, of what they characterize as Hispanics, women, homosexuals, what have you, that those interests should be negated, that nobody should be talking about those kinds of things, and instead we should be going at the white workers, and then in the process of doing that, have some kind of trickle-down politic that would be beneficial to everybody. So we've heard that kind of ridiculous claim. And I think that the only thing that our community has going for it right now, I truly believe this, is the existence of the Black is Back Coalition that nearly alone has been involved in a very serious struggle to offer the Black community an alternative and saying, you don't have to be afraid of this and you don't have to rely on the analysis of the Democratic Party or the Democratic elite. We see just how they're clairvoyant. We see just how much they are on top of the political situation in this country. We can turn to ourselves, and that's the critical thing that we have to do. And every advance that we've had as a people in this country has been when we've been fighting in our own interests, not relying on either of the political parties or any other force outside of ourselves as a decisive factor in how we were going to move forward.
Many of the folks who backed Hillary say that this election, this candidate, this soon-to-be president, is somehow the worst of all time, and that politics, as previously practiced, has to go out the window, and everyone should jump on the anti-Trump bandwagon before it's too late.
Yeah, I hear that. And when they say the anti-Trump bandwagon, what they mean is on the Democratic Party bandwagon. And what that requires of us is to ignore the track record of the Democratic Party for the longest period of time, under Obama, with Clinton in bed with him, under the Clinton who preceded Obama. The suggestion is that this anti-Trump rhetoric really says that we have to go for the Democratic Party. And I'm afraid that even much of what we will see in the streets on January 20th in opposition to Trump is really the part of it is the Democratic Party attempting to reassert its relevance outside of the electoral process initially. I mean, even I was in a meeting not too long ago with some people who were organizing for January 20th, and they announced that there was going to be this Million Women's March, and nobody knew who organized it, where it was coming from, who leads it, or anything like that. But I believe that what we're looking at is that, in that instance, in January 14th with Al Sharpton, again, is the Democratic Party, sectors of that so-called Democratic Party coalition, that sector that has been characterized as identity politic, attempting to reassert its relevance. And I think this whole notion of identity politic, the reliance and dependency of our movement on the Democratic Party or any other political entity or institution like that speaks to the weakness of our movement and not its strength. And I believe the coalition, the Black is Black Coalition for Social Justice, the January 14th rally for self-determination is the evidence of a movement reasserting itself, reasserting its identity, reasserting its relevancy, and calling on Black people everywhere to unite around a platform, a real, genuine self-determination platform that can be embraced by anybody who truly believes in progress and freedom for Black people.
One of the first acts of the Black is Back coalition back in 2009 was to march on the White House and denounce President Obama, who'd been in office for less than a year. Could anyone doubt that a coalition like that will denounce, resist, and work against a Trump presidency at least as hard as against Obama?
Could anybody doubt that? And I'm not sure that many of, again, of the anti-Trump forces will ever forgive us, by the way, for marching on the White House of Obama. I think, as you know, many people were startled and many people were upset about the fact that we were doing that. And many people refused to come into the coalition because our first act was the rally and the march on Obama's White House. But everything that we've done has proved true. And I think that it's been helpful because if the had not been for the coalition, there wouldn't have been any kind of meaningful organized resistance to, nor explanation for what Obama was doing, what the Democratic Party was doing. And we would have just had a whole bunch of people who had pretended to be leaders simply tailing behind the kind of hysteria that followed the election of Barack Obama in our communities. And I think that our coalition did an incredibly significant, truly historically important act by having that demonstration, not only just for the interests of African people, but peoples around the world. We had to make a statement that imperialism has not changed. U.S. imperialism is the same. And the election of Barack Hussein Obama did nothing to change that. And there were many friends of our movement, friends of our struggle, who really tried to embrace Obama when he was elected. You remember how even Hugo Chavez gave him a book and others gave him a pass, assuming and hoping that he was going to be different from other U.S. imperialist presidents. But we knew. And that's the thing that I shall forever be proud of in terms of what the coalition was able to do, because we did go upstream. And there were many Africans, again, who were upset, but there were many who were not upset and wanted somebody to stand up and take a stance. And we provided that kind of leadership, while others who now claimed and then claimed then to be these extraordinary revolutionaries fell in line and united with this imperialism under a white power in the black face of Barack Hussein Obama. our presence as a coalition has been critical. And what we are doing now, look at the lineup. We've got people like Charles Barron, the New York State Assemblyman. We've got yourself. We've got Margaret Kimberly. We've got Nellie Bailey. We've got people who've been working around the reparations questions for all of their lives almost, who are lining up, and people are bringing people just like themselves, the mothers of people who've been murdered by the police, etc. This is a whole new movement, a new assertive effort by people who have not been in the big tent of the sellouts. And it's a refreshing kind of thing that I think will prove also to be extremely important in advancing our struggle. This is an entirely new thing where the careerists are being pushed out of the way by history and by what the coalition is involved in taking on. And the efforts to drag us back into this death grip of the Democratic Party as our only means of being able to win our freedom, I think those days are nearing an end.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.